I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman. With me today is Eric Meyer. You probably know him as author of numerous books on CSS, the co-founder of An Event Apart Conference, now in its 10th year, and most significantly for today, the co-author with Sarah Wasserbecher of Design for Real Life, a book about turning edge cases into stress cases and stuff like that. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Jeffrey. How's things?
Things are good. Things are good. You're in Ohio today?
I am.
In your home office?
Yep.
Paint a picture for us.
Let's see. It's a combination office slash guest room. We did a thing where when we renovated the house, we put a Murphy bed in here, and then the underside of the Murphy bed is the whiteboards for the office. So
nice.
Yeah. I have like a wall of whiteboards, and then you pull it down, and there's a bed. Anyway, it's like a 12 by 15 or something like that room, maybe 11 by 15. I don't remember exactly. And it's got my desk. And
so it's a three-family dwelling in my town of New York.
Yes. It actually, in New York, you could probably have several families here. But I live in Cleveland Heights, inner ring suburb of Cleveland, Ohio, and when we renovated it, we expanded it somewhat, so it's a little bit bigger than the houses around it. But
what do you see out the window?
So out the side window, I can see the side of our neighbor's house and a few trees beyond that. And then out the back window, I can see our backyard, and there's a lot of trees there. It's a very heavily forested city, and so it's one of the reasons that we moved here, actually. But there's a in the strips between houses, where in some cities you would have, you know, like an alleyway or something like that, mm-hmm. there's trees, basically. A hugely deep strip of trees, but trees nonetheless.
So. And are they hikeable? Is that sort of communal land? Can people walk
no,
around in it?
No, not in this area. There are some there are some suburbs near us where that is, it's a little bit bigger and it's sort of a communal land, but where we are is a little bit more compact. The Cleveland Heights, our area of it was built in the teens and 20s, so our house was built in 1920. So it'll be a century home in just a few years.
Wow.
And
brick? Is it mostly brick?
It's wood and wood shingle, which is covered with vinyl in our case, but it's tasteful vinyl, we like to think. But there are brick houses. One of the things about the street, having been built in around 1915 to 1925, is that it was built. All the houses were built before suburb planners believed that you just cranked out the same house in house after house. So every house on the street is different, basically.
Nice.
Yeah, we like it.
My dad lives in an area like that in Pittsburgh, where mm-hmm. every house is different, and it is much nicer.
Yeah. So I mean, I get that in the 50s after the war, it was we got to build suburbs as fast as possible, and
sure,
it was just easier to have four blueprints, and you just built one of the four blueprints, and two of the blueprints were just mirror symmetries of the other two blueprints. But
also, there was that whole around that time. There were architects, very influential architects, who believed the city beautiful could be a thing, and that instead of a street grid with row houses or apartment buildings, they could sort of build a park-like space and then put basically identical units, so you knew what you were getting.
Right.
Excuse me. Wow.
Because they're tight.
Thank you. Thank you very much. People believed that your soul could disappear from your body when you sneezed, and that's why we say that. You knew that, right?
I think I did, yeah. At some point. I may have forgotten.
Excuse me. I have a cold all winter and allergies all summer. It's fun, ladies. And gentlemen. So let's talk about this book. You and Sarah... before we get into what the book's about, which is going to be the fun of today. How did it come about that you found a collaborator and that this happened the way it happened?
So I had had I've been doing a talk. I'd had a talk in mind for a while, and then I started doing it in late 2014, called Designing for Crisis, which I was considering writing, right, as sort of in book format, but it didn't feel like it was an entire book. And so right at the end of 2014, the Facebook Year in Review came out, and I had a kind of difficult experience with that. I wrote a blog post about it. It went viral, which was about the last thing I expected, to the point of, Jeremy Keith, like, sent up pictures like, "You're in the independent UK." Really? Oh, okay. And then right around that same time, Sarah published a blog post called Personal Histories, which when I read it, I was like, now that I'm starting to get an idea of what the sort of this larger landscape is that Designing for Crisis fits into.
That was about the thought, although no one intended to hurt or to cause pain. She was signing up for something and they were asking, like, "What's your brother's name?" And her brother had passed away and it was a painful subject and
If I remember, it was, she was filling out a form with the German government and it said effectively, what nth child are you of your mother? So basically, are you the first child, second child, third child, fourth child, whatever. And she was about to say second when she realized, wait, I'm technically the third child that my mother had. There was another child who died in infancy before I was born. So are they asking, like, number children of children who are alive now, or literally the number of children that my mother gave birth to? And it wasn't clear. And it was obviously, I mean, it was kind of an emotionally difficult thing for her because of, you know, that whole personal history.
And it hadn't occurred to anyone who made the form because they didn't test it on anyone. They didn't, you know, if the person who made the form didn't have the experience of a miscarriage like that or of a child, an infant death, might not occur to them.
Right. And, you know, so this was a situation where, you know, like Sarah said, in addition to just sort of the personal difficulty because of that situation, it was also, well, how do you actually want me to answer this? And there was no way, like, the form gave no hint as to what they were actually asking for. This is something that my son could run into, Joshua, who's our third child, but he's the only one of two children now, basically. I don't know if he'll ever encounter a form that wants to know that information in that way, and yet it's a possibility, right? So like, I had been doing this Designing for Crisis talk and thinking about writing it up, and then Year in Review helped me see that there was a much larger context that Designing for Crisis fit into, and then Sarah's post helped me see that there was a much larger context beyond the stuff that I had come to see from the Year in Review situation. So it was sort of this expanding, whoa, the landscape, I keep seeing more and more of this land.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was thinking about getting in touch with her, and I think you recommended that I get in touch with her, and a couple other people as well were like, "Have you seen this post? This is just exactly what you're talking about." I was like, "Yes, I have." So I emailed her and said, "I've been thinking about writing a book, and I think I would love it if you would write it with me. I think we should do it together because I think we're approaching the same thing, but from different starting points, and that combination will make the book much stronger." And Sarah agreed. And looking at the book as it exists now, I think that was right. Is that, you know, it could not have been anything like it is. It couldn't have been anywhere near what it is without Sarah's input. And help.
It's in a way more than the sum of the parts,
yeah.
Because the two of you created something new.
Right.
It's the book starts fairly gently in a fairly, you know, not in an extreme place at all. You talk about a cute and playful microcopy, the kind that we're all taught to write, the kind that some of us have been writing for years, right? You know, so there's an error page, let's make it fun, or, you know, once you start getting into apps, the example was get a room, you two. I think it might have been Swarm. And someone kept showing up with the same person in the same location a couple of times and said, get a room, you two. I don't remember which app it actually was. But they said, yeah, you've just told me to get a room with my stalker. Thanks.
Right. And that's a small illustration, but it's kind of a good intro.
Or fun fact is another one, right? Mm-hmm. Fun fact about Shakespeare comes up on Medium, which seems great. Like, I think someone had written a post and they had two readers so far. So Medium, trying to make that seem like a positive, said, fun fact, Shakespeare only had two readers on, you know, his first sonnet or whatever.
Right.
But he had just written a post about his friend's death. So
fun
fact was wildly inappropriate for him and just...
It felt really weird and off-putting, and that's the thing. So there are two approaches that we take, or I don't know if two approaches is the right way to put this, but there are kind of two sides to this, to what we're saying, which is one is that, you know, if you're not careful, you can actually really hurt people, right? And I don't know if fun. I don't know if the fun fact is an example of it was Kevin Hoffman who experienced it. I believe. I don't know if he was really hurt. That's really for him to say. But the flip
get a room person was clearly
could probably I would think that would be very very disconcerting and painful. But the flip side too, you know, if you're in a situation where you're like, well, okay, so people got hurt. That's for them to deal with. The flip side is that there's a business case here to not do that kind of thing, right? Because, you know, the get a room, you just told me to get a room with my stalker. That's someone who might not want to use that service anymore or you know, go to that website or whatever it is. And so, you know, I'm all for doing the right thing because it's the right thing. But that has proven to be, unfortunately, not a popular view in the business world. So, but there's also the, you know, like Facebook with Year in Review. They did this thing at the end of 2014 where they stuck basically an ad into people's timelines if they hadn't done Year in Review that had a preview image. And a lot of people got, you know, basically it would say, here's what your year looked like. And there's a little window and it had a, you know, pretty much it auto-inserted whatever picture the person had posted to Facebook that had gotten the most engagement, the most activity. Regardless of what that activity was, right? The most likes or the most comments or the most views or the most whatever. I don't know what their exact algorithm was to figure out which picture they should use. But, you know, so I got a picture of my daughter, Rebecca, who had died 6 months previously. And someone else got a picture of an apartment building on fire. And a man in Texas got a picture of his father's the urn containing his father's ashes. Somebody else I talked to.
With balloons and people dancing.
Right, with sort of party clip art around it. Yeah, someone else that I heard from, they got a picture of a sonogram, which was a sonogram from a pregnancy that ended in miscarriage.
Jeez.
So at the time that picture went up, you know, even if Facebook had done sentiment analysis, right? Even if they'd looked at all the comments, if they'd had code that looked at the comments and looked for things like, you know, congratulations, happy, or I'm so sorry, sad, that sort of thing, that picture still would have come up. Right? A lot of these
as
things,
a positive,
right? Because at the time it because was posted, it was totally a positive. It was only later that it became a negative, right? So, you know, it became literally an international news story, which is a little weird. This whole thing about Year in Review, which is not the kind of PR that Facebook would probably or any business would want. But it also, like, for someone like me who got this picture of my daughter with the clip art, like it was a moment of, like, I was shocked.
And it wasn't just any horrified. It wasn't just any photo either, right?
It was a picture of Rebecca's face, which I had posted shortly after she died, and a bunch of people had commented or whatever. That had gotten the most engaged. I don't post a lot of pictures to Facebook in the first place, right. So they didn't have a lot to draw from in my case. I don't want to spend a huge amount of time on your interview, but the point being that for some,
the feature itself was the problem, that even if they had tools of analysis, which they didn't, because those could get false positives from something that started positive and became negative, even if they had those tools, it's a tricky feature. So
very.
What do you do when you want to inject some life into your website and cute guide copy is a traditional, low cost way of doing that? But I mean, we certainly don't want to go to a place where we're afraid to have any warmth or so obviously you're not recommending that everything be completely neutral and for fear that somebody would be bothered. So what kind of, I don't know if heuristics is the right word, but what do you teach in the book as ways to evaluate or to be creative but avoid hurting people? Is there a question, I saw an article you guys wrote where you said, if you're not asking, could this be used to hurt someone, you're failing.
Yeah, that was actually a quote, we quoted Zoe Quinn, who said that, because Zoe Quinn
it's kind of brilliant and simple.
Yeah, and I mean she's been unfortunately on the receiving end of a lot of online abuse, and in some cases not online. Because Zoe Quinn, for those who don't recognize the name, was the person who was the initial target of what became Gamergate. So she had said. She had said that, and we quote her in the article. And
Gamergate, just in case anybody, it was...
I figure people could Google that.
Okay.
Because it's a very long and complicated story. But anyway, so there are a number of things that we recommend. Actually, the thing about the book, about Design for Real Life, is that the first section is sort of a set of principles, and then the second section is ways to incorporate those principles into your process. So this is not a book that says throw out your entire process and start from scratch and do it this way, right? It's the whatever you're doing now, that's fine, right? We're not here to tell you that Agile is better than Waterfall or vice versa. I don't even know if I got those terms right, but anyway, sorry,
you did.
It's
you did, but
yeah, okay.
But it's talking about making stress cases instead of edge cases, and bringing those edge cases to the center, and planning for the worst, and knowing your own assumptions. Like those are the core messages in the beginning of the book. No. You had a thing like QA for emotion, which I find pretty fascinating. Sorry.
Sorry.
Oh my gosh.
I would say that's boiled down, our first sort of our first principle would be just start thinking about these things, right? Like this is not something that designers are trained to think about. We're not trained to think about the failure modes typically.
Which is strange. Engineers are trained in this.
Right. Engineers are programmers usually.
Programmers are trained. Like what happens if it fails?
Right.
What is Because everything is a this or a something else.
Right.
But in design, it's a this.
Yeah, pretty much. Because I think what we're trained to do, design to me...
Including experience design.
Coming at it a little bit from the outside feels very aspirational. Mm. Right? It feels like a thing where we aspire to deliver people to the sort of the best state, the highest state that we can attain with this thing, right? This potato peeler should be the best damn potato peeler. They should be happy to be peeling potatoes because this is so awesome,
right?
So well designed, this potato peeler,
and it works too.
Yeah, I mean,
as someone who's bought I actually bought a Philips Stark toilet brush, not recently, This was 20 years ago. I wouldn't do it today. But 20 years ago, like when I moved to New York, the first thing I bought was a Philippe Starck toilet brush. It was like, because I wanted design in my life.
Right.
At every level. And
there you go. The best damn toilet brush you'd ever used?
No, it looked great.
Okay.
Now, that's the other thing about Philippe Starck. Like some of his things, like he has these glasses that look amazing, but but they tend to like snap and cut your finger.
Oh, so
there's design that actually looks amazing and works amazingly. Mm-hmm. And then there's design that looks amazing and doesn't necessarily. So, yeah. No offense, right. Mr. Starck. And,
Everyone's got their ups and downs. But, yeah, so, but maybe it's just the designers I've hung out with, but, you know, sort of this idea of let's have people like interact with this thing and they come away from it like feeling so much better, right? It was such a better experience than they ever could have anticipated, which is fine, right?
Corresponds to your the right thing to do as opposed to your business case, right?
Well, but the thing is that it's very easy to become focused just on that aspirational case, sort of that idealized outcome,
the idealized and not user.
Think about like how could this maybe not go well. So this is like designing designing a car, right? An automobile, which is only about looking great and has no safety features. We took out the airbags because they made the steering wheel look clunky, right? We took out the seatbelts because the strap that doesn't fit with our aesthetic of someone, you know, carefree on the road. Okay, like nobody would do that at this point, right? Because it's understood instinctively that cars move fast enough and are heavy enough and are in situations that if you don't have those things, that can be deadly. But that doesn't mean that every car looks like a mid 70s Volvo, right? It's they're boxy.
There's plenty
safe.
There's plenty of design flexibility within the constraint of have it not kill people.
Right. And so that's one of the things that we're saying is that there's plenty of design flexibility within the constraint of, try not to hurt or offend or otherwise drive away people. Because what we're doing now in design a lot is, and especially web design, is a lot closer to us personally than we have traditionally. Like more and more of our lives are moving online, as it were. Our photos, our communications with our friends and our family, all that kind of stuff. That's all being done online.
And we've got it in our pocket and we're holding it up to our face and we're holding it to our loved ones' faces and we're touching it with our fingers, which is different from the sitting back at a desk with a gray box, right? The traditional computer, mediated with a mouse and all that other stuff, right? It's now very, very personal. So it feels very personal.
You're right. And a lot of the things like services that have been created and design is happening in a more personal and more emotionally intimate space.
And you mentioned health in your book and mm-hmm. The app, not health, the subject. When my computer device that connects me to all my friends and family and everyone in the world and all the information also knows my heartbeat and, if I got enough sleep and how many steps I took and how many stairs I climbed, it feels very personal.
Yes. And yet that's one of our cases where it became almost, sort of rejective in a way when Apple launched HealthKit. Initially, there was no way for women to track their menstrual cycles.
How did that even happen?
Well, yeah, I wasn't there at Apple, so I can't say for certain. But from the outside, what I would guess is that they didn't ask themselves, basically, who are we not thinking of? What are we not considering? Who?
But did only guys work on the app?
It's entirely possible. Knowing what we know about Silicon Valley and gender representation at places like Apple, where I think it's like 90%, 10%, 90% men, 10% women. Apple might be 85-15. I don't remember their exact stats, but it's in that, right? It's something like 85-90, 95% men. And so it's possible there were no women working on it. It's also possible that there were, but they also became sort of part of this, you know, they got focused on this particular vision.
I guess the first things that leap to mind are people want to track their calories or their nutrients and their exercises. That's where this stuff starts. It starts with the fitness community. But even when Apple realized that they'd done this, and it took them a year to get menstrual cycles, wasn't there also a problem with the way they initially implemented it, where it was great for women who wanted to get pregnant, but
that was a different product.
That was a different product. Okay, yeah. As I've heard you talk about that too. It was a okay.
Yeah.
So not to mix them, but those are both instructive to me.
So you know, one of the things that we say in the book is that's an example of, you know, if Apple, the designers at Apple, or the programmers, who basically everyone who was working on this product, had a way to sort of challenge their assumptions, to challenge their vision, and, you know, in effect, to say, okay, this is what we're envisioning, this is what we're assuming in the process of envisioning that. Like, okay, so what happens if we subvert those assumptions? What happens if we're wrong about those assumptions?
This is why I think it's such an important book, not just for the stress cases, although that's critical, and and compassionately, they have a much greater importance than percentage of people affected. If only 10 people have their heart broken by your app, is that like, oh, it was only 10 people that had their heart broken? No, that's not good, right?
No.
The stakes make it not good. But besides that, it's a super important book because it reminds designers to challenge our assumptions. And we have to do that as a society. We have to do that in relationships, in business. We have to do that if we're trying to sell a product. And in design, we're doing all those things. We have a relationship with the user. We're selling them something or encouraging some kind of behavior. And boy, we better be right in what we think about their lives.
Yeah. Or at least not wrong.
Yeah. There you go.
If that helps, right?
Because that's better. Yes.
Because the thing is, you know, someone like Facebook or Apple or Google or, you know, even smaller sites and smaller products that still have thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people interacting with them, you can't be right about every single one of them, right? Like, you can't make a single assumption to have it hold true all the way across. But you can avoid making assumptions. especially in things like copyright, like assuming that if someone's having trouble logging in to a account page, like assuming that they just forgot their password and making a joke about it, when it might not be that at all. It might be that they're starting to have motor neuron degeneration and they're having trouble typing. And that, you know, rather than saying, you know, oh, hey, it all, you know, we all forget things sometimes, maybe, you know, one too many drinks last night. Okay.
There's at least
three pitfalls right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Could be a recovering alcoholic with 1 week sober.
Right.
Who doesn't have a sense of humor about that.
Right. Or you know, someone
with a degenerative disease who really doesn't like being compared to a drunk.
Right. Or someone who is beginning to have neural degeneration from Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or something like that and knows it and yet is still, you know, on their own. They're still living independently because it hasn't progressed that far yet.
Now, I got locked out of Delta for entering my password wrong. Mm-hmm. I love Delta. I got to say, they're my favorite airline. I fly them all the time. They're not paying me to say this. I really do like Delta. And their app is really good, except I ran afoul of this one little thing. Mm-hmm. When you have to sign in, occasionally they bump you out and you have to sign back in.
Right.
And I have sort of four passwords in my mind that that I rotate among, and I hadn't used any of them when I signed up for Delta, and I wasn't near the document that reminds me. Anyway, so I entered, and then I also, because they have the black dots, you're never sure if you're just, you might be entering the correct one, but you don't know, you can't look and go, oh, this one didn't work, it must be the other one, because you're not sure which, if they're similar, you're not sure which one you, anyway.
Right.
And I was locked out for a day. I called, they say, call, you must call now. And when I called, thinking they would, you know, verify my ID, I just wanted to check in. Mm-hmm. I called figuring that they would talk, they'd talk to me for a few minutes, verify my social security number, et cetera, and go, okay, this is him, he can go back in. Which I thought, are they afraid that I'm going to buy a bunch of airline tickets? Like, I'm not sure what they're protecting me from, but okay. Mm-hmm. You know, fair enough, security.
Right.
At the end of this half-hour conversation, she basically told me that I couldn't get in for 24 hours. That was their policy. She could have told me that at the beginning. Hi.
Right.
This, in fact, they could have said that at the beginning. When someone blah, 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 we lock them out for at least 24 hours. That's now the case with you. However, if you call us to verify that you're you, we'll unlock it at the end of 24 hours. I mean, there's something they could have done in the messaging to let me know.
Right.
We're not going to solve your problem if you call. We've just created a problem for you.
Mm-hmm.
Because we arbitrarily decided that 4 is how many times you can enter your password before you must be Hitler.
Right. And so that would be an example where I, you know, I would say, first of all, I assume that they did not joke in their microcopy. They just simply said that there was a problem and you need to call. Right. So that would not
that
be
was
a place
good.
To joke.
Right. Right. But although people do.
Oh, yes.
MailChimp used to, because they had the jocular, and then they figured out, like, this is a place where our little joking monkey doesn't joke.
Yeah, so if anyone who's listening to this hasn't been to voiceandtone.com, which is from MailChimp, I can't recommend it enough, because it's a great example of where they say things like, if you're doing a success message, this is a time to be funny, right? Because people are generally, they're relieved, they're happy, you know, they're glad that this worked out, right? So that's fine. But if it's an error message or a compliance alert or something like that, this is not a time to joke around, right? Like, joking around people who are frustrated is a bad idea. And yet we see it, right? We see it fairly frequently, unfortunately, where people do a thing where it's, you know, you make a joke about having forgotten your password. And this is another situation. This is also a case where I would say, you know, if the people at Delta should test that particular that decision, that experience decision of, you've input your password incorrectly, you know, so many times, we're going to literally lock you out for 24 hours. I wonder if they've evaluated that in you know, sort of in the user scenario of somebody who has to get a flight this instant because something, you know, they need to go be with their friend who's been in a car accident, or, you know, their father had a heart attack and is in the hospital and they need to get to California, or, you know, they need to fly across the country as soon as possible. And this is a moment where they're under a lot of stress. This is a stress case, right? And so maybe, you know, they have that sort of forgetfulness, or they're not quite concentrating on their typing when they're typing in the password because there's so much of their mental capacity is taken up with just being worried and stressed out about the situation that is requiring them to go onto the Delta website. And then, okay,
almost always the case.
For 24 hours.
Almost always the case. Right.
Right.
So they didn't think that through.
Well, whether or not they did.
They didn't think the stress case through.
Right.
This would be the time.
Not,
yeah.
You know.
If they did, their conclusions are odd.
Yeah, just because, and, you know, you must call. And maybe if you call in that situation, they're like, okay, I'll get you over to wherever and we'll, you know, we'll.
Oh, that's the other thing. They can't actually help you. They can't even check you in. When you do this, they say, well, we can't really check you in. But, and then they say, you know, you can just use the, what do you call number? There's a number that you get when you do a transaction, like a transaction number. You could just type that in. Anybody could type that in and check you in. So you don't have to be you.
So they locked you out.
They locked you out for fear that you're not you, but they'll let anybody, your travel agent, your dog, a criminal, Hitler, anybody can check you in with that number, which what's the point of checking in to begin with, makes you wonder. And
yeah,
the whole thing
starts
to seem like theater.
Right. That would be a thing that I would think they could reevaluate. Just because, you know. That whole process is experience design, right? Whether it was intentional or not,
mm-hmm.
it still is.
Right.
And so that's something that, that maybe they could reconsider. Just because, yeah, you know, it's when we're under stress, we make more errors, and their process seems to be almost perfectly tuned to basically trap people who are already under stress and add to their stress, which, you know, you or me or you know, people in our industry might look at that and go, okay, I see how that happens. But people who are not, right? How many people in that sort of who are in that situation and then they get locked out from Delta and it becomes a much bigger hassle to try to get these flights that they need? How many of them are just going to go, man, you know, I was in a moment of crisis. I had to get home. Delta made my life more difficult. I'm never flying Delta again.
And that would take away from all the other caring stuff that they do every right. other step of the way. It's like the horrible – is another one. I love Disney. Don't get me wrong. But like the Disney – and they may have changed. I haven't used their website in a couple of years. Like several years ago, I tried to register for a Disney vacation on the Disney website. And whereas every other part of the Disney experience is completely designed mm-hmm. for maximum, you know – I've told you, the maids stop cleaning if they hear a child crying, because my child was crying. She dropped her ice cream. The maid left the room she was making and got my child the new ice cream free.
Wow.
Because a child shouldn't lose their ice cream at Disney, right?
And right.
Wow. We didn't have to enter our room number, nothing. And it's because the maid, her number one job was to make sure that the guests are happy.
Right.
Right. It wasn't to make the bed or clean the toilet. Mm-hmm. And that's true of everyone there. But their website, at the mm-hmm. time at least in my experience of using it, was not the most user-friendly or logical. It was mm-hmm. pretty hard for me to get the vacation I wanted, even though I was basically begging to throw money at them. I was getting divorced. I was worried about my kid, and I basically wanted her to have the best summer ever, right?
Right.
And I was like – And I was doing well, right? It was a good year. So mm-hmm. I was just like, yeah, where else would I spend it? Let's do this. And I couldn't. I ended up hiring a travel agent, which was fine. But like, you know, they have a website, yet I had to hire a travel agent to get the vacation I wanted, which is a little bizarre. And especially – so it's another example of just companies can be great at experience design except for some reason in this one area. Before we continue our wonderful conversation, I would like to thank our delightful sponsor. This episode of The Big Web Show is brought to you by Braintree Payments. By next year, maybe even next week, there could be a whole new way to pay. Maybe it will be the next Bitcoin or the next Apple Pay or maybe even both. Fortunately, Braintree's full-stack payment platform is easily adaptable to whatever the future holds, so you can adapt easily too. Accept everything from pounds to PayPal to that next big innovation from any device with just one integration. And when that new payment method comes out, all you'll have to do is update a few lines of code. No late nights, no complicated recoding, no stress about staying ahead of the curve. Braintree Payments is here to help. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/bigwebshow. That's braintreepayments.com/bigwebshow. These are simple, secure payments with code you can integrate quickly. And if you don't have time or just don't feel confident, you can give them a call and they'll even handle the integration for you and walk you through it. Braintree's code supports Android, iOS, and JavaScript clients, and they have SDKs in many languages: .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, Ruby. It's elegant code with clear documentation. Again, BraintreePayments.com/bigwebshow. Thank you, Braintree Payments. And back to you, Eric.
Hey.
Hey there. So here we are. Yep. We talked about touchy subjects, which is a big point in the book. Right. We talked about one of the things, and even though I knew it because I was there when this happened, it made me squirm a little in reading it in the book. There's a discussion about a list of parts. So List Apart is a magazine which I published for many years, and Sarah was the editor at the time. And we noticed that submissions by writers were falling off. And when Sarah pointed out that our copy, which at the time we wrote it years ago, we wanted to be aspirational. We wanted to people to feel like they were really stepping up when they wrote for A List Apart. But it turned out to be kind of a turnoff in the in the changing environment. I guess all these things culminate in one of the things that you advise is what would a human do, or what is that? Right. WWHD?
Yeah. Well, what would a human do?
What would a human do? Explain what that means a little bit.
So, in effect, what it means is, you know, pretend that this this bit of microcopy or this action or whatever it is actually something that a human is doing. Now, does that seem like something they would do? So, as an example, Kay Kiefer Lee of MailChimp fame and many other things as well has a thing that she recommends, which is just read your copy aloud as if you were saying, as if you were speaking those things to somebody else, like you were talking to somebody and then this was just part of your conversation, and ask yourself, does this sound like something a person would say, or does it sound stilted, or does it sound hostile, or does it sound robotic, or does it sound weird, or whatever, right? That's one of the ways that she recommends that you improve your copy. And that sort of in a larger context, like what would a human do? So with A List Apart, you know, it's not quite the what would a human do, because these are both things humans would do. But one of them was, here's, you know, the original copy was sort of a,
maybe you can be one of us, the
right,
few, the proud.
Maybe you can join us. Are you good enough, basically?
When I wrote that, I was riffing on, obviously, the Marines pitch.
I think
anyone knew that.
Right. And then, so maybe that's something that a human would do. But then the question is that the tone that you're going? Like, is that what you're trying to present to the people who are coming? And, you know, for some sites, maybe it is. I mean, for the Marines, the actual Marines or any other military service, that probably absolutely makes sense to say, you know, are you good enough to be one of us?
Because if you have doubts about that, you're not going to make it through the program.
Yeah, probably. Whereas the copy that A List Apart changed to was more welcoming. It was, yes, we want you to submit. Please, we're looking for new voices. We're looking to hear what you have to say.
Yeah.
And it didn't promise, right? At no point did it say, we want to hear what you have to say and we'll absolutely publish you regardless, right? Yeah. Didn't say that at all. But it was more sort of welcoming, more inclusive, more, you know, whatever term you want to use there. It wasn't sort of as standoffish. It was much more, hey, we're all part of the community. We want to hear what everyone has to say. And then, you know, perhaps we'll publish. But
one of the big changes, one of the big positive effects Sarah had during her tenure as editor-in-chief is that she brought a lot of more inclusiveness to A List Apart, more conscious inclusiveness. It's not like it was ever an exclusive. It's not like we were ever trying to keep anybody out.
It was more consciously inclusive and
yes,
more oriented that way.
Yes.
Yeah, and that, I think that's a good lesson for a lot of the things that people are working on now, a lot of the things that we're designing, especially online, because, you know, you do have to, I mean, generally, you know, if you're working on a site, you are expecting to interact with a very large and diverse audience. And so, you know, I mean, if you're trying to focus on a very specific market segment and you literally want to keep everyone else out, okay, then you know that, right? And you know to design and to write your copy in that direction. But most services and companies are not like that. And being inclusive isn't necessarily what it is. Is it's basically saying, you know, we want everyone to use our thing, to interact with us, to buy our product or to use our service or to communicate over our network or whatever it is that you're trying to do. You know, Facebook is
whoever you are, we want you to feel welcome. You belong here.
Basically,
you belong here.
Yeah, or at least we don't want you to feel unwelcome, right? We don't want you to feel rejected, in effect, to be pushed away.
It's a problem in every level of our society, and it starts in school.
Yep.
Right, but I know I know how hard the teachers work in public school, and yet there can be cases where kids, just because they're different one way or another, they feel excluded socially by other kids and maybe by the curriculum itself, because it's not – it's a great curriculum for 80% of the kids who go, but not for the stress cases.
Right.
So this is everywhere. This is everywhere.
Yeah, and you and I, having middle school-age daughters, we're – I'm sure you're experiencing this every bit as much as I am, seeing this happen. And and I remember when I was 12, it wasn't – 12 is not easy for anybody so far as I could tell. And yeah, so these are the kinds of things that we're trying to basically – that the book is trying to help people sort of anticipate.
And I like that it's starting in our community. This seems like a change that is happening – or could happen in a lot of areas in life. And I like that our community is being active about it. I really like that you and Sarah have written this book and that our company published it, right? A Book of Art published it. And that and that kind of drawing a little line in the sand and saying, well, you want to be better than this.
Yeah. And I mean, we were really glad that we were able to publish with a Book of Art. And it's the kind of thing where – and I also should say that neither Sarah nor I would even pretend that this is that this book is the like the final statement.
Oh no, clearly.
Yeah, no. The book and I think we say explicitly in the book, we're starting it, like we're trying to start a conversation.
You're starting a conversation.
To start this. Because it's not something that we've thought about. It's not something we're trained to do. If we start figuring this out, if we start training ourselves to do this, as designers, as developers, even then, we may find other ways that this can be applied, other best practices that we haven't thought of yet. It's the sort of thing where we want to get people thinking about this, and honestly, Sarah and I would love to hear what people do with it, because they may well come back to us and say, here's what we came up with, and we go, oh my gosh, that's amazing.
You are getting some of that feedback now, right, on Twitter and so forth?
Starting to a little bit. What most of the feedback now seems to me more in the vein of, this is really important, and I can't wait to start applying this, or people saying, right, so how let's even assume that I agree with you. How do we do this? Which is the point at which I say, well, the second half of the book is, discusses that in some detail and gives a whole lot of different, techniques and tools.
The designated dissenter.
Right. Things like that.
Things like that.
The pre-mortem, which people seem to be. Yeah, actually, that seems to be the thing that people are responding to the most so far.
That makes sense.
Yeah, is the idea of doing a pre-mortem as opposed to a post-mortem.
Wow.
Yeah, right.
Worth the price of admission for that alone.
There you go.
Very true.
Yeah, and those are some of the things. My talk this year at An Event Apart is based on the book, and so we talk about some of that stuff, or I talk about some of that stuff with the, here's why this should be done, and here are at least a couple of things. I don't have room in an hour. I couldn't even put in all the things all the techniques that we have in the book. But it's like, here's a couple that you could consider using in your process. One of them is the pre-mortem. I think the designated dissenter is the other one. So yeah, and the interesting thing has been a question we've gotten a couple of times is how did we find examples for the book? And the reaction that Sarah and I had was, man, once you sort of realize this, you see them everywhere, right? They're just everywhere. We struggled, in fact,
to leave them out.
Yeah, one of our biggest struggles is which ones do we include and which ones do we not include because we just don't have room.
Have you thought about making a blog or?
Yes, it's been considered, but the. The book's been out, a month now? A little bit more than a month?
Do you think that would be negative if you just kept listing examples of – I mean, would that be pushing the – look at these bad people doing it wrong versus
– Well, our if we were to do it, it would be – we would try to have the positives as well as the negatives. But sometimes just a list of here's what not to do can be useful. I don't know if you've seen the Tumblr, the crew list opt-outs, which is basically a collection of all those sort of passive-aggressive bits of copy on opt-outs. Things like, you know, put in your email address here to sign up for our newsletter. No thanks. I hate knowledge and fun.
Right. I hate those things.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So there's a Tumblr called the Cruelest Opt-Outs, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And that has a whole collection of those. And like people will point at those and be like, yes, these things. And I think it does have a couple of you know, sort of positive examples. Like, this is really good. Sometimes, though, it's easier to see this. Like, you notice somebody who trips and falls, and you don't really notice someone who just walks past you without tripping and falling.
Right.
You
know what I mean? It's the air conditioner. Nobody ever says, wow, it's just perfectly adjusted.
Exactly. You only ever notice if it's too hot or too cold. Right. So, if we were to do it, and it's something we've talked about, we would try to have a good mixture of, you know, okay, yesterday's was really horrible and everyone facepalmed when they saw it. And here's one today that's pretty good.
Got it.
Yeah. But
could be cool.
Yeah, it could be. And it's one of those things, like I say, we've discussed, but the writing the book, we actually started writing the book early last summer. So a year ago now, we hadn't even started writing. We were researching and we were compiling examples and sort of hammering out the structure of the book. But we had not actually started writing it at this point last year. And so we, you know, in amongst all the other stuff that we had to do, you know, me and Avena Part and other writing and Sarah, her consultancy.
Oh, you've done plenty.
And stuff like that. Yeah. We were writing this book and editing this book and re-editing the book and updating the book during the editing process because more stuff happened.
But maybe this is also something where you let the community pitch in.
Yeah. It's
having
it's a
started a conversation. I mean,
I think basically what I'm saying is, you know, we had like this concentrated effort leading up to the book being published. And then since then we've been trying to sort of spread the word, and now is the time, I think, for us to start thinking about, should we do a Tumblr? Should we try a sort of a blog of things? Yeah. So it's
right.
Yeah. We'll see. I mean, if we did set it up, it would absolutely be a, you know, send us your examples. But we haven't done that yet. So it was, and I do have to say it was not only pretty amazing to publish with a book apart, but something that I don't think I've actually mentioned before, the fact that it was book number 18.
And you like that because?
Well, because I have learned that I am not myself Jewish, but my wife is Jewish. In Judaism, the number 18 is a sort of a symbol for life. Because in Hebrew, I guess the Hebrew letters for 18 look very close to the Hebrew for high, which is life. So
I did not know that.
Yeah. Well, I've learned that over the years. Apparently when you have a fundraiser at a synagogue, oftentimes the suggested, contributions are in multiples of 18 for that reason.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was completely, it was just a coincidence that we happened to get book number 18 of the A Book Apart series. But when I saw that, it was like, oh, that's pretty cool. I like that.
And you're not a gambler, so I'm not worried.
I am not a gambler.
So you're not going to go bet on 18 now?
No, I am not a gambler at all.
I just watched a television program where that happened. The guy kept seeing a certain number, so he bet $90,000 on it and lost.
Yeah, that's sort of the flip side of Run Lola Run.
All I really remember about that movie is it was kind of like Rashomon, like the same thing happened four different ways.
Yeah, it was sort of like Sliding Doors, except I think it was before Sliding Doors.
Right.
But yeah, it was 20. She puts everything on 20 on a roulette wheel and wins in that case. Okay. Spoilers. Darn it.
Oh, no.
Oh! Anyway.
I hear she runs, too. Ooh,
there is running. There's a fair amount of running in that movie.
We are running out of time.
Yeah. Okay.
So I want to thank you.
Thank you.
This is Eric Meyer talking about planning for the worst, identifying assumptions. What would a human do? Great stuff. Great stuff. Design for Real Life is the book. Thank you to Eric and his co-author, Sarah Wachibetcher, for the book. Thank you to Braintree Payments for sponsoring this episode. Thank you to the 5x5 Network for running this program, and we will see you all again soon.